Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, votes, votes. We don't need no stinking votes. Republicans try and woo Hispanic voters after the surprise roundhouse kick to the head that was Obama's immigration policy change. ¿Son los republicanos fuera de contacto con la comunidad hispana? That is Spanish for, are the Republicans out of touch with the Hispanic community? Speaking of la comunidad hispana, reports today say that Marco Rubio has not even been vetted. Is he out officially? And could Bob Hines be right again? The president is on spring break with 18 of his closest friends. Wait, who invited Putin? Is the Eurozone any better off with the election results of Spain and Greece? Can the Eurozone be saved? Mitch Daniels is preparing to leave his office hours on his door as he prepares to leave politics and head to take over the helm at Purdue University. This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. Political Insiders, this is your favorite weekly talk show on all things political. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., by way of a very sunny, hot, and humid state of Oklahoma. It's a split edition of Backroom Politics, but joining me as they do every week, usually to my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress representing representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He's the former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is Congressman Al Swift. Al, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's hot back here. I suppose that doesn't impress you, though.
No, I'm in Oklahoma in the middle of Oklahoma in summer. It's not impressive at all. Joining me to my 11 o'clock, as he does usually every Tuesday, but he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce, longtime Senate staffer. He has served under last count 4 presidents. He is a very distinguished and now very married fellow at the Stimson Center. He is Secretary Alan Moore. Congratulations, Alan.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I have to confess I haven't been giving a whole lot of thought lately to everything political, having been up in northern Minnesota, although I did drive through Wisconsin on the day of the recall election, so I
really?
Got a heavy dose of that. Yep.
Did you get in touch with your inner Walkerness?
I got to reflect long and hard on everything that was going on up there.
I'm sure that's what you were reflecting on your wedding weekend. That's exactly what we were thinking. Hey, and joining me to our 12 o'clock, usually, if I'm sitting there and Shelley's with him, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, hello, sir.
How are you, fellas? Well, listen, I tell you, it may be it's hot here, Justin, as Al said, but we have one advantage. No
What's
dust.
That? Oh, that's true.
No, I will
give you that.
We got a lot of green stuff around here. So
that's
right. We're not
joining
getting, but we have a lot of humidity.
That's good. Well, joining me today, he is also the former chairman of the Democratic Party in the great state of Maryland. He is longtime Washington insider, Carl Tuven. Carl, how are you?
We're great. We're fine. How are you?
Doing fine. And also with me is our international affairs expert. He is the vice president of the Eurasia Center for China Affairs. He is a bar-certified attorney in the great state of New York and the District of Columbia, and a member of the Supreme Court Bar. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to be here at Shelley's, and I'm missing everybody, but we're going to have a great show today.
Yes, and there is a lot of big stuff going on right now. Can't even begin to tell you. The first subject we want to touch on is basically, I mean, we were gone last week, and then all of a sudden all heck breaks loose last Friday when the president announces changes to his immigration policy. His immigration policy has changed to the point where, if you're basically a youngster and you're looking kind of promising, well, basically Immigration and Customs Enforcement won't go and find you to deport you. That's kind of it in a nutshell. But the big news was the fact that, A, he announced it a few weeks before the Republicans were planning to announce it. Number one, and Alan, since you have been gone so long and we miss your insight, Alan, what surprised you about the announcement in the Rose Garden last Friday by the president?
Not much. But let me say, I wasn't expecting it, but reflecting on it, it was just a bald political move. Obviously, he's been in office for 3.5 years. Could have taken this kind of initiative long ago. Felt like here it's sort of cherry picking an issue. Here's a piece where actually Marco Rubio had been talking a little bit about some sort of special status for these young kids, a variation on what had been called the Dream Act, not an automatic path to citizenship. And the president decided, shoot, I can do that. I can do that under my executive authority. Why not do it? And it was clearly a political move, but that doesn't mean it was a bad political move. It left the Republicans sort of scrambling and kicking themselves for not having gotten a more comprehensive bill out there. The problem with doing it this way is that it's probably a setback to the more comprehensive reform that we really need in this country, and that businesses who rely on temporary workers, whether they're highly trained engineers or landscape companies looking for workers on construction sites and to mow lawns, frankly, it does nothing for them and probably sets back the process.
And by the way, if you want to join the conversation, Alan, I don't know if you knew this, but we have an 800 number, a toll-free number you can dial.
Oh, man. I had no idea.
It's amazing. Since you've been gone, we've gone to the 21st century. You can actually call in and ask any question, anything political of our roundtable at 877-662-3713. Again, that number, 877-662-3713. Back to topic. Congressman Al, that had to have been kind of a nice little chest-puffing moment for the Democrats when they came out and they literally pulled the secret roundhouse kick to the gut to the Republicans on something they were hoping to announce weeks from now. It even caught L.A. Mayor Alex Villagarosa by surprise. He said on MSNBC when it actually happened, he says, I wasn't expecting this for a couple of weeks. Is this just a sign of they needed some good news, Congressman Al?
Well, I suppose there was some of that, but let's face it, the Republicans have been slow on their feet for months and they haven't been doing things that could be done anyway. And so I think it's kind of their just desserts that the president finally decided, I'm tired of waiting around for you yahoos. I'll just go ahead and do it myself.
But Bob, do you agree with Congressman Al that they actually kind of fell asleep at the wheel on this one, or were they still trying to work out a maneuver to get something that was legitimately passable in both houses?
Well, I think the latter is true, but I think it's also true what Al said.
How badly did they fall asleep at the wheel on this one, Bob?
Well, you know, that's to be determined. I would think that it probably solidifies a lot of the Hispanic vote in behalf of the president. But the fact of the matter is, I think, as Alan said earlier, what it really does, if you're looking for a long-term solution, something that really need be done, this ain't it. You've got to do something legislatively, and this will undoubtedly make it easier to put that off. So it's a short-term political gain for the president, legitimately, and he has that power to do it, and he did it. But it's a short-term solution to just a piece of a much bigger problem.
But Alan Moore, this brings up a good question, because there's actually two sides of this story. Number one is the political maneuvering that the White House was able to pull in getting this out weeks before even some of the administration insiders knew about, and catch the Republican Party flat-footed. But the debate still goes on about whether or not this is actually legitimate use of his authority. And on top of the fact is this even effective?
Well, those certainly are legitimate questions. From my reading of it, I don't think he overreached here. He's not giving them a pathway to citizenship, which of course is a part of the bigger issue and what the Dream Act is all about for people who came here as kids and didn't break any laws. It was their parents who broke the laws. Before we break our arms patting the president on the back here for this brilliant political stroke, it's like most things in politics. It's very rare that there's a free lunch, and there is another side to this from a political standpoint, and that is that all of a sudden you've got thousands of young people who can be visible and legal in the marketplace for jobs, at the same time that American citizens just out of college, just out of high school, or even looking for summer work can't find jobs. And here's another pool of now legal entrance into that labor pool. I'm not trying to make a fight with it, because I'm pretty open-minded when it comes to liberalizing our immigration laws, but I'm talking purely from a political standpoint that you're going to find situations all around the country where people are going to say, oh, good, that's just exactly what my new high school grad or college grad kid needs, more competition in this really, really difficult job market.
But, you know, we're finding in Congressman Al, we're finding that in the political side of this, this also causes a little bit of heartburn with the House, and particularly with House Speaker Boehner. House Speaker Boehner said after the president's remark, and I quote, "I think the president's announcement on immigration, it puts everybody in a difficult position," unquote. He went on further to say, quote, "I think we all have concerns for those who are caught in this trap, though no fault of their own are here, but the president's actions are going to make it much more difficult for us to work in a bipartisan way to get a permanent solution," unquote. Al, do you think that Boehner's just spinning this for political maneuvering, or has the president literally gone behind the back of Congress and usurped their authority?
No, I do not think the latter. I think John Boehner must be very frustrated. I can understand that. But the fact is the Republicans haven't behaved for this whole Congress in ways that would encourage the president to care a whole lot about whether he offends them or not. They have been quite offensive, I think, themselves. So I Boehner had to say something. That was as good as anything, but I don't take it very seriously.
Bob, do you agree with that?
Yeah, pretty much. I can see it. It seems to me that it was a good political move by the president. The Republicans have been slow to move on it. They knew we knew they were moving, but they were one step behind on this one.
But Alan, I mean, there is argument, and there is a lot of criticism coming out of the fact that, in fact, this presidential order, he's basically usurped the authority of Congress. Is that just Republican rhetoric, or in fact, did he go out of bounds? What's your take?
Well, no. It's not him usurping Congress. The question is whether he was operating inside the law. Laws are passed by Congress, and if there's a legitimate challenge to the law here, and some people are suggesting there is, but it's not obvious to me from what I've read about it that they pretty carefully danced around, not danced around, but maneuvered around the restrictions in the law. It is interesting that the president a couple of years ago made it very clear on this world of immigration. He said, My hands are tied. The law is clear. I can't do more than I'm doing. And then all of a sudden here, a few months out, he said, oh, well, maybe I can do some stuff. There's no getting around no denying the sort of the politics of all of this. I was simply trying to say earlier that, yeah, the politics probably goes in his favor, but not cleanly so. There are going to be some other problems. But I think that if people really do believe that he overstepped his legal boundaries, then you'll have lawsuits. I read that today already there's a bill in the House that would cut back his ability to do this. I cannot see that passing. Even if it passed the House, it would get bottled up in the Senate. So I think this is going to be the policy. But it's an executive order which could be rescinded by a future president, or by this president for that matter. Romney wasn't sure. He happened to be on television Sunday and was asked, well, what do you think about this? And he hemmed and hawed around. Obviously, they hadn't thought it through all the way. I think it was smarter to hem and haw than to say, oh, yeah, we'll rescind this in a heartbeat. He's trying to be careful. But they weren't expecting this. It'll get sorted out.
Go ahead.
I kind of wonder what the political thinking is of the Republicans that are trying to rescind it. On the one hand, they're kind of miffed because the president stole their thunder on the issue, but if then they go in and try and undo what the president did, it seems to me that they will not be making positive points with Hispanics.
Well, as you know better than anybody, a handful, one or a small group of representatives or senators can introduce a bill to do anything. It'll get a moment's press notice, and then it'll disappear. If the Republicans really do try to turn back on this, wow, that would be interesting, because this is an area, this particular subject is one that, you know, the Republicans had been talking about a little bit, and Obama, whether he stole their thunder or whether they too had been thinking about it, who knows? But it's about as sympathetic a group as you can find, and what he's giving them, you know, is not massive. It's not a pathway to citizenship.
Carl Tuven.
No, and think about this, if you will, for just a moment. This is Bob. But, I mean, the Republicans have already missed a beat on this one. And now if they're going to actually introduce a bill, they're going to just double down on a mistake, it seems to me.
Well, but here's the question, though. You know, when we talk about this from an authoritative standpoint, does the president have the authority to make this presidential order? U.S. News and World Report is reporting today that there's a memorandum of senior officials, both at ICE, CIS, and at the DHS level, Department of Homeland Security, Citizens and Immigration Services, and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, for those of you playing without a playbook at home. The reality is they came out in a memorandum and said this memorandum confirms no substantive right, immigration status way, or pathway to citizenship. However, it does say in a DHS memo that only the Congress, quote, acting through its legislative authority can confer these rights, unquote, and says, quote, should enforce the nation's immigration laws against certain young people, that is the instruction to federal officials. Go ahead. Bob, you were going to say something?
No, I'm.
Oh, okay.
What I think I just heard you say was that some part of the administration is in effect raising questions about this.
Yeah, I mean the bottom line here is that DHS insiders, even the Office of General Counsel inside DHS, is sending out memos saying, hey, they have to enforce the nation's immigration laws as they are set. Only Congress acting, and I quote, acting through its legislative authority can confer these rights. And Secretary Napolitano instructs her employees to use prosecutorial discretion, which is saying, turn your cheek. That's got to put the agents in a really hard spot, doesn't it, Bob?
Yeah, it does. It certainly does. But the bottom line politically for me, it still is that it's going to be a plus for the administration with respect to the Hispanic community. Now, if it turns out that the president was playing fast and loose with his authority, that may very well inure to him some damage from citizens who say, what is he doing? That he ought to know what the law is. He certainly has good lawyers, and he did it for political reasons, and that may make that may be a problem for him, let's say, in October or September when the campaign gets hot. But right now, unless that's the case, this is pretty much a plus for him.
Yeah, but Congressman Al, doesn't it seem a little odd right now that as you look at the action? I mean, this isn't the first time that Republicans have accused the president of basically overriding Congress and just passing his own laws or enforcing the laws that are on the books at his own free will and whim.
Well, no, it's not the first time, but it's not the first time it's been done by anybody. I recall Democrats saying the same thing about Republican presidents when they got one upped. So it's kind of standard politics in D.C. as usual.
And Justin, how does this compare to what Reagan did back in 86 with his comprehensive immigration reform? Were these sort of same issues raised back then, and how does what Obama is doing now compare to what Reagan did? Did it generate the same level of controversy as it is now?
My understanding was it created a little bit of a buzz, but I don't think that Reagan's actions were this concrete or decisive. I don't know. I'd have to defer to somebody like Congressman Al or Bob Hines, if you guys recall that.
I don't.
There's a whole different attitude now. You've got these two parties in Congress fighting with one another. You've got one party who is only position is, in many cases, getting rid of this president, throwing him out of office. You've got McConnell saying that and others saying that in the Republican Party. Bruce Priebus, the national chairman, says the same thing. So you've got to look at the atmosphere that this was done under, and this is the way they're reacting.
No, interesting point, Carl. Interesting point.
Well, Carl, sorry, are you suggesting that back in Reagan's day, the Democrats were resoundingly embracing Reagan and didn't want to get him out of office?
I am not saying that at all. Alan, I think the whole thing was entirely different than it is today.
How so, Carl? Carl, how so?
What? I can't hear you.
How so, Carl?
How so? The acrimony between the two parties in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. We didn't have this acrimony back in the days of Ronald Reagan. It's a much different atmosphere that's been brought on over the last 10, 15 years that didn't happen in the 90s with Ronald Reagan. A lot of people like Ronald Reagan. You know, Tip O'Neill would fight like hell. We talked about this. Tip O'Neill would fight like heck with him during the day. But in the evening, he would go up to the White House. They'd sit down. They'd talk. They'd plan a strategy. And Tip says, well, you know, I might have to come out and say a few harsh things about it, but I'll get my people to support this. You don't have that today.
Interesting
well,
point.
I brought it up only because there was an enormous amount of ridicule of Ronald Reagan by Democrats throughout his presidency. We forget that, but there was. And they did it to Bush. The Republicans did it to Clinton. The Democrats really piled on with Bush 43, and now I'm not saying it's been an even unchanging environment, but let's not pretend that back then, just because Tip and Ronald Reagan could go off and have a drink and tell some stories with each other, that the Democrats were all sweet and nice and kind and friendly to Ronald Reagan. They ripped him apart. They love to ridicule him as this Hollywood know-nothing who looks a lot better in retrospect, but at the time there was an enormous amount of antagonism directed at him by Democrats and people in the press.
Yeah, but Alan, I mean, you have to admit though that even the venomous tone back then was not nearly as strong as it is today.
What I've said is it is continuing to change. But it's not like everybody loved each other then and was happy to work together and compromise. There was ugly, ugly stuff said back then and done. There's even more of it today.
Yeah, I agree with that. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue on this topic, but want to talk about the topic. Who has got the most connectivity with Hispanic voters, and how is that going to play out in the election coming up here in the next few months? This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We are in a split edition, but we'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller, Lulu back in town. And I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu, the most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town, yeah.
From Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., on Blog Talk Radio, as we are every Tuesday. We're going to continue the discussion going on from the great political maneuvering, or the absolute asleep at the wheel maneuvering that the Republicans did or the Democrats did, however you want to take that view. But the reality is, this raises a bigger question, along with the question of, did in fact President Obama go outside the bounds of the law? Or on top of the fact, did President Obama pull a huge political coup? The bigger question is that the big vote that everybody is trying to woo away to their side is the Hispanic vote. Now the question, now then, let's be clear. Nobody on this panel is of great Hispanic origin or claims to have great insight into the Hispanic community. The closest one I think might be Alan Moore. And that's only because he was in Mexico within the past 60 days. The reality is The Hispanic vote is a vote that everybody's trying to catch. The big question is, and Bob, I'll go to you, is the Republican Party out of touch with the Hispanic community? And will it cost us possibly the election?
Well,
Bob?
My feeling is that it isn't so much that the Republican membership of the Congress or the leaders, whatever you want to call them, are so much is a matter of don't know what the Hispanics are looking for in the terms of equality in a number of areas, but it's the question that they have had a hard time. The Republicans have had a hard time trying to put together some kind of a program that would address some of those issues, and at the same time would not anger some other parts of their supporters. So they've been trapped to some extent, a little bit maybe by their own slowness to move.
But
the fact of the matter is, it is a fair thing to say that a substantial percentage of the Hispanic vote is a vote that's going to vote for the president because they feel more in tune with him in his policies than they do with Republican policy.
Alan Moore, you agree with that?
Well, I don't. It's not that I disagree. I think that it's a mistake to think about the Hispanic vote as somehow monolithic, because we've got Cubans down in Florida, and everybody likes to talk about Marco Rubio's potential attraction to Hispanics writ large. And then there's a big question: well, do the southwestern Mexican-based Hispanics resonate with a Cuban in Florida? And how about guest workers? Guest workers or illegals who are scattered all over the upper Midwest and working on farms and so on. There's no easy single way to talk to Hispanics any more than there's an easy way to talk to a lot of different ethnic groups when you start spreading them out across the country. What Obama did in this particular case is he tried to cherry pick an issue where he thought it would be pretty hard to argue against on the merits. Forget whether it's legal or not, because there's a lot of sympathy for this particular group of people who came here as kids and have kept their noses clean ever since. But that's a relatively small group of the illegals in America, and he's hoping that he can be nice to that group at the same time that he doesn't offend other voters, principally white voters, or for that matter, other Hispanics who don't want more competition for the scarce jobs that are out there.
Well, but
so,
I mean, you're talking about a situation right now, and Congressman Al, I'll go to you, where roughly 63% of the American electorate agree with the policy that President Obama had put out there. And what we have is a situation where now, ultimately, and unfortunately, we've got a busy office here in the campaign headquarters in Oklahoma. But going back to the question, Congressman Al, how is it that, you know, with 63% of the voters in America supporting the maneuver, President Obama obviously struck a chord here. Excuse me. What is the actual right answer as far as assuaging everybody, because Cubans are not a big fan of Obama's, and they haven't been in the past few years?
No, the Cubans are a distinct group from other Latin American people, and it's because their central view has to do with Batista and Fidel Castro and all of that stuff, whereas everybody else is less concerned with that. I think where the Republicans really missed the boat was when they failed to support George Bush's approach to trying to solve the whole problem. He had a pretty good approach, and it was essentially, and the Democrats, of course, said it wasn't good enough, which you can expect them to do, but the Republicans weren't supporting it either. And I think they continue to get all panicky over these people are illegal, when many of them have lived here for 25 years, haven't broken any other laws. They are here without a proper forms and what have you, but they are not criminals in the sense that they stick up banks and rape women. So I think the Republicans just don't have a very realistic look at this, and they blew a big chance when they didn't support George Bush.
Bob Hines.
Well, Al just said what I think is what I was going to say back 8 years ago or so, I guess it is now. Bush had a pretty darn good program, and it was something that, as Al says, the Democrats were saying it's not enough, but too many Republicans said it's a bad idea. And I think it was a terrible mistake on the part of a lot of congressional Republicans to not see that this was a growing issue, and to have a Republican be able to possibly, quote, solve the problem, unquote, would have been a very useful thing if you're looking at it from a political standpoint, because the reality is in a number of our western states there is a substantial percentage of folks in the country who are here illegally, and they're good citizens, as Al said. They're working people, and they're part of the country.
We might as well understand that and agree
that it's a good idea.
Yeah, but
we've had waves of immigrants forever in this country. We've never turned any immigrants away as a group to say you can't come in any. We don't want you here. We've always been very open, and I see no reason why we shouldn't.
Whoa! Yes, we have. We have all kinds of quotas all across the board on immigrants now.
And Alan Moore.
Yeah, I know we do.
We shut those doors decades ago. There's people, there's millions and millions of people all over the world who would love to be able to get to America, and there just isn't room for everybody, and that's why we have systems, quotas, country to country, queues for getting in, and so on. Having said that, we've also got very porous borders, and we've got a lot of economic need in this country, so it's been a place where Latinos from Mexico, Central America, South America would find their way up here, and they were willing to do the rotten work, typically agriculture-related work, that Americans increasingly weren't willing to do. So we had the job demand. They had the labor force. They were thrilled to have this kind of chance. But this was sort of following economic response. I don't think that one can say that America has always been welcoming to all immigrants, because we just shut. I mean, it was decades ago we started shutting the doors, setting up the systems, establishing quotas.
If I didn't make it clear, I wasn't saying anybody who wants to knock the door gets in. But we've always been a pretty welcoming country. Even today, we're probably, if you look at the rest of the world, we're still one of the most welcoming country there is.
Yeah, I think what we need to take a look at is that, you know, it's been very, very selective in how we do this. For example, it was convenient back in 1994 when we had the Haitian boat lift and the Cuban boat lift. We had the Haitians that were being picked up and returned back to Haiti on Coast Guard cutters. Then President Obama was allowing Cubans to come in, whether we picked them up at water on the water side or on the land side. It was only then that President Clinton, after he said, well, you're doing it to Haitians, you got to do it to the Cubans, he went with the feed dry policy. There seems to be a little bit of presidential discretion on how they actually want to enforce our immigration policies. Would you agree with that, Congressman Al?
Oh, yeah. The whole idea is that the strange thing is both Bob and Alan are right about how this country approaches immigrants. Overall, in the long run, we are welcoming. But we have opposed virtually every group when it initially wanted to come in. Bob will tell you about his grandfather reading a sign saying, no Irish need apply.
Are you, so, I mean, are you saying that all we're doing is seeing a full circle of today's Hispanic is...
Yes.
Yesterday's
what I'm saying
Irish?
Is we always raise hell when the new group comes, and then they settle in and we calm down and forget about it and we start quoting the Statue of Liberty again. Very short memories. What we're doing now, we have done to the Eastern Europeans, we've done to some Western Europeans, we have certainly done to the Asians, we've done it all before, and we are obviously going to, at some point, have resolved this, and we won't think anything about Hispanics. But right now, they're new. They're different. They're taking our jobs. All the arguments that have been used over and over and over again with every new group of people that have wanted to come to this country.
I think there's some difference in the case of Hispanics because, let's face it, some of them were there. A, they were there first. They were here first. B, there are tens of millions of Hispanics who are here. Many were born here. Many are multiple generation. And then many are here illegally. And I think the numbers of Hispanics sort of swamp any historical precedent we've ever had. They've been able to get here, come across the land. They didn't have to go across an ocean. So it wasn't, you know, a few more ships full of Irish. It was thousands and thousands of people coming across our borders every day, and we're setting up all of these walls and fancy technologies to try to stop the flow, even as we try to figure out what to do with people who knowingly broke a law to get here and then have lived here and have kids here. Have grandchildren here in many cases. Nothing new about this. It's just that a really, really challenging both issue on the merits, but it's also and it's challenging politically. But it's not just political. It's like, gosh, what do we do? Do we just simply say, never mind, everybody here is fine, but now we're shutting the doors? Do we just say, forget shutting the doors, let everybody in who wants to come? I mean, there's some real hard choices and decisions to make, A, but B, then there's all the politics. And right now we're playing the politics more than we're trying to figure out the long-term solution. And there's no easy answer on the politics because, as we learned last time with President Bush, who was about as forward-thinking on this stuff as anybody, we watched John McCain be out front and then retreat. We watched Democrats who were on both sides of the issue, those who said you're not doing enough and others who said, I don't like this, my folks don't like this, and Republicans, you had increasingly people who just said, nope, that's too much. I think that the politics are complicated, but the issue itself is not easy.
And that's the real challenge for the Republican Party is how are they able to court the Hispanic vote, yet at the same time be tough on the national security, closing the borders. At the same time, want to alienate this large voting bloc of people like the Republican Party did in California when they passed that proposition that created a huge backlash among the Latinos and other minorities to the point now where the Republican Party in California has great difficulty in getting votes outside of whites.
The other point to make is the point that Mayor Bloomberg likes to make in every speech and when he's asked a question about this subject. He indicates that if we really wanted to solve the Social Security problem, the Medicare problem, et cetera, we would bring all these people in, put them to work, let them pay taxes, let them pay Social Security, then do all these things, it would help solve some of our problems in this country.
Yeah, but how does that solve the problems in the country, though? Is if we take that approach, those people eventually, excuse me, those people eventually could be viable taxpaying citizens, but if they do not acclimate into the society, if they do not acclimate into jobs that will sustain them and their families, they then become an additional burden on the economy. I mean, is that not something to consider when we look at all this? Is that part of maybe something we don't understand?
Well, wait just a minute, Dal. Think about it. I am not aware of any group that has come to this country that hasn't assimilated itself. I don't think that's a, I can understand the concern that it might, you know, that it might be here, but I don't think that it's, I don't think it's likely. I think that, and I'm not sure that Mr. Bloomberg's solution is that much, because obviously we know that the biggest problem we have right now is this monster of the baby boomers are no longer working, full time and going to be doing so for 20 years. They're in effect hitting the 65 age bracket, and they're qualifying. They're no longer paying out into these programs. They're now beginning to becoming recipients of these programs, and that's one of the reasons that everybody is so concerned long term about health care expenses and Social Security, because the smaller group of citizens, a smaller group, is in their 40s, is a smaller population group than is the group now in their middle 60s getting ready to start needing help.
Yeah, but Bob, when you look at the numbers though, just on the plain data that's coming out of, let's say, Washington, when you look at the different demographics, for example, and I'm not saying this to pick on the Haitian community, but Haitian immigrants, 46% of Haitian immigrants that enter this country use at least one major welfare program. That's a tax burden. You look at others in the community. You look at the Cuban community, for example, which has done much more, and that number is much less, about trying to acclimate and become part of that working class. And they've got numbers for everybody. This is just one example. Does that not, when we look at the immigration policy, does that number not resonate with a lot of the folks in, like, let's say, the Midwest that don't have that kind of exposure maybe to the immigration community?
Let me say something about the demographics, because I think there's a lot of confusion about this. There's this notion that people come into the country and go immediately on welfare or immediately to county hospitals and start getting a bunch of benefits and live a leisurely life on the rest of us. That just isn't backed up by the facts. What Bloomberg says is based on historical fact, and that is that for a country an industrialized country to continue to grow and prosper, especially if it has programs like we do of social insurance, where current people pay for the benefits of retirees, you need a population that grows slowly. Most industrialized countries around the world are shrinking. All over Europe and in Japan, they have it, and in Russia, probably worst of all for some different reasons, they've got declining population. And that is a recipe for disaster when you've got people living longer, qualifying for old age benefits, and not having enough people to generate the tax revenue to pay for it. One of the reasons that the U.S. has a still growing population is not because our birth rate is up, but because we still have both somewhat open doors for immigrants and then a lot of illegals who come in. They actually do contribute to the society and to social programs, as long as they have Social Security numbers and so on. We need that. We need to have the 2.1% growth in population to hold even. And when our birth rate is below that, we've got to fill it up with immigrants. Many of the countries of Europe don't do that. So they've got a 1.6 or 1.7% birth rate, no immigrants or very few, and they're just looking at this Armageddon of out in front of them. Their economies aren't growing. So, but you can't just throw the doors wide open and say, "Come on down, everybody," and you know that would be its own disaster. But our pretty open immigration policy has been an important contributor to our ability to continue to grow and not have an even worse problem with Social Security and Medicare.
Congressman Al, you have something to say on that?
I have often thought that the Republicans want to be tough on immigration. I mean, it's very important to Republicans that they show a very manly nature and very strong and very powerful. And so they picked the wrong thing. I think where they should draw the line, and I would support them on this, is we want one language in this country. And more and more and more, we see everything in English and in Spanish. This is not good for the immigrants. It is not good for the immigrants to be incapable of reading the newspaper, reading magazines, being able to be informed. They need to assimilate. Now, we've always had, by the second generation of immigrants, everybody's been pretty well assimilated. And I think that will happen with Hispanics. By the second generation, the generation born here, raised here, they're going to speak English just fine, unless we continue to prop them up with telling them everything in their original language.
Well, Al, let me jump in real quick. Let me ask you this question. Does the FCC take away the license of Telemundo or Univision because they don't speak English?
No, and I think they don't take, you know, we've got other languages that are out there too. That's okay. But when you start issuing ballots in many languages, when you start having other things that people have to do on a daily basis in both languages, what I'm saying is that if I think the Republicans would be smart to get softer on the overall problem of immigration and tougher on the fact that they have to, you know, that the goal is everybody speaks English by the first full generation. And then we haven't got any problem. Then these people can get jobs and so forth and so on.
Carl,
well, that gets to the whole issue of the English language ballots initiatives that have come up in several states, and to the elimination of bilingual education in the schools as a way to encourage that everybody speaks English. So this is raising a lot of controversial issues that I don't think are going to be decided anytime soon.
Well, you're right, but I think bilingual education, of course, that's where it would go. God bless it. But the fact is, having your child be able to learn a second language in school is not the thing that you want to stop. I mean, you want to encourage that. The world is getting smaller. My granddaughter is learning her grade school arithmetic in Spanish, and I don't see anything wrong with that. That's English-speaking people learning Spanish. And I think that's an appropriate thing.
Well, but I still go back to the idea, though. I mean, and Al, I got to tell you something. First of all, you're starting to sound like a Midwestern Republican in some of your rhetoric there. But the reality is, when you...
I'm very versatile, you know. You know that.
You are. You know what? I'm going to take a break because I have got to get something to drink or else my throat is going to completely close up. It's that Oklahoma dust getting to me. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I do want to finish this topic real quick, and then we'll also tie back into the what's going on down in Cabo San Lucas, down in Mexico. We're going to talk about the G20 going on and the body language that we're seeing. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., in a split edition. Hey, by the way, it's happy hour. I don't know, Al, Bob, if you're at Shelley's, go order your martinis and your wine. Alan, I know that you're not at Shelley's.
No.
But light up a cigar, let's enjoy it, and I'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Happy Renato.
You know, for those who listen to Backroom Politics and know about Shelley's Backroom, they think of it as some sort of cigar bar where politicians go to smoke their cigars and drink their martinis. Actually, what you don't know about Shelley's Backroom has one of the greatest menus in the city. I kid you not. You've got the campfire wings, famous campfire wings, 1 pound of roasted, not fried, seasoned marinated jumbo chicken rings served with their own special honey mustard sauce. Folks, if you like chicken wings, you've never had the campfire wings. Best wings in the city, bar none, I guarantee. If you don't like it, Al, you can call us up and tell us that you don't like it. You have daily specials. Come down on a day when they have the Justin Chicken Sandwich, the sandwich named after me, breaded chicken breast, provolone cheese, thick-cut bacon on a Kaiser roll served with a honey mustard sauce. Folks, it doesn't get more artery-clogging than that, but it is worth it. Come down to Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the premier sponsor of Backroom Politics. Back here live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics, live in a split edition on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to continue our discussion from the last hour real quick on the immigration situation. The president's announcement to allow young illegal immigrants and have ICE and the other immigration agencies turn their cheek, if you will, and not going after them for deportation, sparked a lot of debate, and it's got us talking about the current immigration policy here in America and a deeper lying issue. Al, you were going and you had a comment that you were talking about before, saying that English is part of the issue in the immigration question today.
No, they banned that.
Congressman Al.
I was saying that. I think that I used to live close to the Canadian border, and I saw what having two languages in Canada did. Incredibly wasteful with two languages on every item you sell, and so forth and so on. A lot of wasted effort. The rest of the world is trying to learn English, and why in the world we're trying to help people not learn English in this country, it befuddles me. I am very, very liberal on immigration. I am fairly conservative on the fact that they need to be able to get their citizenship by speaking and understanding English and the information that is taught them. And I don't think that's harsh. I think that if you just will not prop them up by feeding them Spanish all the time, it will happen automatically, as it has over the generations with other groups of immigrants.
Alan Moore, when we look at that, though, that's surprising coming from a liberal Democrat like Al Swift. But that seems to resonate a lot with your more Midwestern-based voters who don't have the necessarily influx of immigrants that they're exposed to, unlike some of, like, let's say, even the East Coast or even your large urban centers on the West Coast. Alan Moore.
Were you still talking about the language issue?
Actually, my question was: is when we look at the comments of Al Swift, that actually resonates a lot with a lot of your more Midwestern types, ones who aren't necessarily exposed to, that are exposed to immigrants like your East Coast cities and your large urban centers on the West Coast. Is that type of mentality being what's driving the Republican policy on immigration? Is that Midwest?
No. That becomes, I think, an excuse. There's just a notion that two things. One, these people broke the law. We can't just give them a free pass. Two, they're going to take our jobs and our kids' jobs. Now, whether those things, the first thing is undeniably true. There was some law breaking, at least by the adults. Figuring out what the right kind of punishment is much a bigger challenge. Whether they're taking job opportunities, that's I think overstated, because so much of the work that particularly Hispanics do is work that Americans don't want to do, won't do for minimum wage, won't do for $10 an hour. I mean, maybe Americans would pick tomatoes for $25 an hour, but then no one would eat tomatoes because we couldn't afford them. So huge sort of challenge there. On the Al issue of language, it's very tempting. And yet, I think practically speaking, it's a complete non-starter. Kids will learn the language. Kids who get into schools, by and large, will learn in English, and I think that needs to be a high priority in the schools. And if the kids are kindergartners, it's less of a challenge than if they're fifth graders who've been going to school and speak Spanish, and then you got to figure out how to bridge that gap. If their parents, their grandparents, hey, only if there's an absolute economic necessity are the parents going to learn functioning English. And in a lot of parts of the country, Spanish is the first language. In the local community, maybe not in the schools, and I think governments can control have a lot of say, if you will, in what's done in the schools, although local control, local schools, local taxpayers, et cetera. But I think that trying to somehow have a language requirement for adults and grandparents, I think that it's way too late. It's just not practical at all. It's just a huge challenge to get millions of people who function fully and completely in America, in parts of this country where everybody around them speaks Spanish, and to say, oops, okay, if you want to actually get that citizenship or get that green card that's perfectly legal, you have to pass an English exam. I don't see it happening.
No, and that isn't quite what I was proposing anyway.
Okay, Al, I think we get the idea of where you're going on that. The bigger question, though, however, when we look at the immigration issue, broad spec, is it's a simple issue of what is legal and what is not legal. I think the big crisis that we're facing is not a question of amnesty. It's not a question of at what point do we break and look the other way versus going after the parents, et cetera. I think it's still a question of, are you here legally? Did you get here within the confines of the law? Because I know for a fact that when I talk to relatives of mine, my sister-in-law, for example, is a legal alien here in the United States. She carries a British passport. It took her years to get her green card and her legal alien status here. And yet, when we turn the other way, for somebody who just happens to come over 48 hours later, since they're young, they're legal, I think that's what causes a lot of the discontent. Am I reading this wrong, Bob Hines?
I don't think you're reading it wrong, but, you know, the reality is there's the problem is so broad in the sense that there are so many different ways people get into the country and how long they're here and what they're doing and what's their family situation. It's a very, you know, it's a very complex problem, and we seem to be unwilling as a nation to try to put it together. I think Alan said earlier, you know, when Bush was trying to get his immigration bill moving, am I right that Ted Kennedy was trying to help him and trying to move it forward a bit? That may have hurt it eventually, I guess, with Republicans. But it's a very interesting juxtaposition about the people who had very different views about most issues were fundamentally trying to come together and find a way to, you know, break this Gordian knot, and it's getting tighter and tighter around our necks all the time.
But I want to go back to the original issue, though, that, you know, with all this discussion, I mean, obviously the immigration policy is something that's going to spark a lot of debate, even in the coming months as we lead up to the general election. But from a larger aspect, does it seem like the Republicans have lost touch with reality with the Hispanic community? And I'm going to go to you, Congressman Al.
Well, I think the Republicans have, yes. That's a short answer, yes. And it's because they want their votes, but they simply want the rigidity of their views on illegality and that kind of thing more. And it doesn't look like this is one of those issues where they can have both.
Bob Hines, has the Republican Party lost touch with the Hispanic community?
With a great deal of it, yes.
How so?
Well, let's put it this way. They got outmaneuvered by the president, as we've been talking. Rubio hasn't got his – it looks like he's not doing anything with the bill. I suspect that has as much to do with there aren't that many Republicans in the Senate who want a bill, and they thought they could get away without doing anything, and obviously the president is one-upped them.
But is it a matter, Carl Tuven, is it a matter of the Republicans have just, not politically been astute enough to keep them, or is the Republican Party literally showing its colors right now more than ever of being the party of old white guys?
I think that's a part of it. And a part of it is they haven't been able to get their act together to do anything about this problem, it seems to me. They haven't, I don't know if they've introduced any bills that would help the situation, or they just maybe felt that they could stay away from it because the Democrats weren't doing anything. Then all of a sudden, Obama pops up and makes this decision to do what he did. And it makes Democrats look good. It makes the Republicans look like, well, you know, we just don't care.
Republicans need a clear and consistent position on immigration, and they haven't seemed to come up with anything. They've let the Democrats take the lead on this issue, and it's going to be interesting to see how the Republicans are going to respond if they're going to put their own immigration plan together and what that would entail.
Alan Moore, is this an Achilles heel for the GOP coming into November?
Well, you know, it appears that it's an Achilles heel, that there's a weakening here. It's, you know, it's going to be a problem in some states. It's not going to be an issue in others.
What about the Obama people?
You know, it's the swing states where Obama's focused like a laser beam, and you know, they've got some smart people who've looked at this and said, we think that this is a net plus for us in these key places. And, you know, who am I to say they're totally wrong? Having said that, I was reflecting on all of this and this history, and I think that in some ways one of the people who did a real disservice to this issue and to the Republican Party was John McCain, because before he started running for president, he was a leader in trying to put a comprehensive plan together. He was the president's go-to guy. He was working with some Democrats on a pretty comprehensive proposal that would have dealt with, you know, this kind of easier or more sympathetic issue with, you know, should there be a pathway to citizenship? Should people have to go home first? What about all the temporary workers that we need, not just in the agricultural fields, but as computer programmers and in high skill jobs that Silicon Valley and other places care so much about, and that our economy, particularly in parts of it, has a lot of reliance on. And McCain was a fundamental leader, and then he completely bailed when he became the presidential candidate, or on the process of becoming the presidential candidate, because he realized that there are states where, for Republicans, this issue was a major loser. And I don't blame him for trying to be a political survivor, but in reflection, it was really, really unfortunate for the issue. The politics, you know, the politics play out the way the politics play out. But I just feel badly that we couldn't, having had an opportunity some years ago with President Bush and with some real leaders in the Senate, it didn't happen. And now it's a political football, and the people who are most affected by this are still left hanging out there wondering what their future holds and whether they're going to be caught and whether they're going to be deported. And that's just a sad commentary on all of us.
Congressman Al, I'll go to you and ask you the same question. Is this the big political Achilles heel that will get the Democrats the White House again?
I just don't believe in the theory that a single issue, unless it's like the economy or war and peace or
Al, let me jump in. It's not so much the issue of immigration, but is the loss of connectivity with the Hispanic community from the Republican Party, is that enough to cost them the White House?
If it gets much worse, yes. If all they're left with are Cubans in Miami in a close election, it could be very significant.
Bob Hines, I heard you jump in and say yes as well.
Well, what I would say is, if the election is as close as it appears that it is going to be, you don't want to have a situation with respect to the Hispanic vote, as the Republicans do now. Now, there are some states that, of course, have a large Hispanic vote, and they're going to vote Democratic no matter what. But take, for example, some of the southwestern states, the population of Hispanics is not that great, but it might be the difference in a relatively evenly balanced Republican-Democratic view of the other voters. So while it may not be decisive in a big picture way, it could be very key in a few close races in states where you're looking at a 49-49 vote going in. So it's pretty tight, and that could be the difference.
Yeah, go ahead, Alan Moore.
Yeah, I just feel compelled to say that I'm kind of chuckling to myself that we're assuming that this single solitary initiative is going to turn the Hispanic tide. Let's give Hispanic voters some credit in being able to think beyond immigration, not to mention just this subset small piece, which doesn't really begin to get at the core issues that Hispanics care about on immigration, and assume that they don't care about everything else that matters in the country. including the economy, wars, and other policies. Let's grant them some the dignity of thinking about them as fully formed, independent thinkers who will draw judgments. This will be a data point that will be more important to them than to a lot of others, but it doesn't begin to say everything about who they are, how they'll vote, or why they would or would not support Obama versus a Romney, and we'll see what he has to say about immigration. But like everybody, the Hispanic voters are going to vote looking at all sorts of issues all around the country, what's going on.
Alan,
the economy is still the big issue for Hispanics as well as everybody else.
Oh, Alan, I don't disagree with you. I guess, and let me clarify the question, is the question isn't whether immigration is enough to tilt it, because we've been talking about immigration, but when we go back to the larger aspect of has the Republican Party lost the connectivity and lost touch with the Hispanic community as a whole, whether it's whether it's its economic policies, whether it's its policies on immigration, whether it's its policies on universal health care, the total package of the GOP, the criticism that we're hearing, especially since Friday, has been that the Republican Party, have lost touch with Hispanics, and I think the question is that enough to cost the election? Is the voting bloc of the Hispanic community so strong right now that they are going to be the quote unquote swing factor in the election in 2012?
There's a lot of time between now and then, and a lot of other issues that they're going to pay attention to. There's clearly some patching up that Republicans have to do, but you know, there are elected Hispanic officials who are Republicans.
I absolutely can. Go ahead.
The trending demographics of this country is Hispanic majorities in states like Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Colorado, California. And if the Republicans don't start getting out of the high 20s, low 30s, they could completely lose national elections. Yes, they do have several high-profile team of politicians, which is very good. They can help mentor and grow the next generation. But there is still an enthusiasm gap among Latinos for the Republican Party. And the leaders have to go back to the drawing board and really focus on targeting the Latino majority, otherwise if they go the way of the African American vote, the Republican Party is destined to be the minority party for years to come.
Interesting point. Well, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we want to talk about what's going on down in Cabo San Lucas. It's spring break down there, apparently, for the G20. They're all doing tequila shots as we speak, I'm sure. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Backroom that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches. They've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays. We'll be right back.
one more time. One more once.
One more once. Yeah, you can never get enough of the great Duke Ellington. Or actually, Count Basie. That was Count Basie's version of that. Hey, this is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., in a split version of our show this week. Hey, real quickly, we're talking about what's going on down in the G20. The G20 summit is going on down in Cabo San Lucas, down in Mexico, in a spring break fashion. They're having some great times down there, especially the relationship between President Barack Obama and newly elected Russian President Vladimir Putin. It's almost deja vu all over again. Hey, I got to go to Alan Moore. Alan, since you were down in Cabo, did you set up a good base for them to get all settled in while you were down there?
Yeah, well, actually, although I wasn't in Cabo, I was over on the other coast. I certainly did all the advanced planning I could possibly do, tasting every tequila imaginable. Rating them and sending that information up to the G20 Sherpas so they could get everything set up.
Thank you for your service, Alan.
Yeah, listen, somebody has to do it, so I figured it might as well be me.
Hey, on the G20, though, and Bob Hines, I'll go to you. Everybody saw the body language between the President Barack Obama and the Russian President Vladimir Putin. There's a really cold tension going on between those two. Bob, is that historical and this is just a continuation of just Putin being Putin?
Well, I think that Putin is, I guess, a somewhat tough-minded guy. But I think this is just not so much a matter of it may be a matter of the personalities may not mesh real well, but I don't think that's really the problem. I think the problem is that there are Putin has certain things he wants to do. He doesn't want to see Assad go, so we have a problem with him there. That's his last friend in the Middle East. So, there are problems out there that he's got that he and Obama just are, no matter if it was they were both Mr. A and Mr. B, they still would have the same kind of a problem because their views of what is good policy and what's the right thing to do is diametrically opposed.
Ralph Winnie, I want to go to you. You know, judging from the body language, there's a really, really cold relationship between Putin and Obama. But are there economic issues that are facing Russians that would cause Putin to hold firm and maybe even kind of push away from Obama instead of them coming together as the G20 summit was originally intended to do?
Well, I think the Russians do not like the pressure that the U.S. and other countries have been putting on them to go along with the sanctions against Syria. I do think it was a positive thing that Obama was able to get Putin to at least come out and agree to stop the fighting in Syria, but the Russians generally play hardball. They don't go along with what the world community wants them to do. They're very nationalistic, and something has to be in it for them. I mean, they have very strong economic interests in many different countries, especially Syria. And it's going to be interesting moving forward to see how if they're going to come on board. I don't think Obama and Putin have the greatest relationship. I think Obama has tried by creating this Russian reset. But there's been a lot of angst and anxiety in this country about what that really means in terms of benefiting America.
But, Ralph, let me ask a question. When we look at the relationship that Barack Obama had with President Medvedev when he was in power versus a relationship with Putin, what's the key dynamic that separates those two?
Well, I think both of them are cut from the same cloth. You know, it's the key for Obama is basically to take a very strong and consistent position and not allow himself to be manipulated, used, or forced into a position that is adversarial to the United States' interests. The Russians are very strong in terms of how they're going to push for articulating their issues, their economic interests, and they don't back down. That's why Nixon was so effective. I mean, he in effect made the Russians afraid of him, which was very, very unusual. I mean, usually it's the Russians that make people afraid of them, just because they take a very strong and dominant position as a way to get things accomplished in their society. So the key for Obama is to stand his ground, articulate strong positions that he's not going to deviate from, and at the same time work with Russia in a spirit of friendship and cooperation to get things accomplished, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it's Europe or in other countries.
Bob Hines, you've been around Washington for several administrations. Are we starting to see a tension like we may have seen between Nixon and Brezhnev?
I think we probably, well, you know, there's no way we can tell this. If perchance we find ourselves with a whole series of problems where the Russians and the United States have a different point of view, as they do with Syria, then it's possible, definitely possible, we'll have some long-term difficulties, you know, talking with them. Right now, that is the biggest problem. I don't see too many others that aren't soluble, but that's right now is a big one. But my guess is that it would be neither country is going to benefit from being unable to work with the other. I mean, both countries would gain from having something that they can work together on, and I would think that once the Syrian thing dissipates, and I don't know when that's going to be, I think things will get better. Hopefully there won't be any other problems spring up since, you know, in between then and now.
Alan Moore,
Alan
Moore, I want to go to you in a follow-up to that is, you know, with the tensions, and obviously Syria is a key grenade pin in this tension that's going on between Moscow and Washington. Are we seeing the beginning of what could be another possible Cold War?
You know, I don't think we know. Just the way Bob, I agree with what Bob said, we don't really know. And I'm so amused that because after these two presidents had spent 2 hours behind closed doors together, and they came out and they talk in the press and deal in with this whole language issue. They're in Mexico, and they got English and Russian, and neither of these guys speaks the other language. Because Putin is looking off the other direction, somebody concludes that there's this great coldness between them. Thank God for the U.S. ambassador, McCall, who happened to be present for this entire conversation, who said afterwards, that's how President Putin is. He's always looks a little detached. He's reflective. So, you know, we got people trying to draw big conclusions because they're not looking at each other. They spent 2 hours together. They spent extra time because they were talking about Syria. They come at it from different standpoints, but they both got a great interest in getting this thing resolved, and they unified around the getting behind Kofi Annan and his efforts. The U.S. made a big blunder when, in the middle of all of this, some helicopters that were being shipped from Russia to Syria, where Secretary Clinton said, you know, how dare they rearm the Syrians, only to find out these were helicopters that had been purchased over 20 years ago and were being refurbished under a pre-existing arrangement and contract. You know, we don't know yet. We know that at least these guys are talking. I think this was only the second time these two had ever spent any time together, because Obama was dealing with Medvedev. Putin wasn't president. Now these guys are trying to establish a relationship and trying to figure out what to do about Syria, and it's a much more complicated issue for Russia than it is for us, and it's not easy for us.
And I agree. I think the issue with the helicopters made the U.S. look very weak and lack decisiveness, and really played to the Russian mindset that the Americans are arrogant and incompetent. And unfortunately, that's a perception that the U.S. has to really overcome when they're trying to create a personal relationship between Obama and Putin.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I want to back up Alan's remarks. And the fact that everybody kind of
Hello.
You got some background noise someplace.
Hello.
Where's Justin?
I think he's been kidnapped by the Democratic Party of
Oklahoma. I'm here. You know what?
You're sure you're not writing an anti-Democratic press release at the moment?
No, I did that earlier, Al. No, what happened was when I put you guys on mute, I put the mute button on me, and it went that way. So that was my fault. Hey, Alan Moore, I want to go back to the situation with the possible Cold War. Is the economics of what Russia has to deal with internally enough to at least have them say, look, we're going to become more nationalistic, whether it's our oil policies, whether it's how we deal with our friends in Syria? We're now starting to look more internal. This globalization just isn't in our best interest.
I don't know. I do know that they have massive domestic challenges. I made reference much earlier about how they have a declining birth rate. They have a shrinking population, and they've got massive declining longevity in that country because of the health problems, including extensive alcoholism of their older generation. So they're not producing babies, and the old folks are dying too young. It's hitting them from both ends of the age spectrum, and life expectancy has declined and is declining in that country. The only thing that props up that government, the only thing, is oil and gas, and they have a lot of it. If you compare them to other countries in the former Soviet Union, the difference between them, for example, and Ukraine is they got oil and gas. Ukraine has to buy oil and gas, and Ukraine is a basket case right now. Even though it's got productive agricultural fields and some minerals and so on, it's just got not enough in the declining infrastructure. Russia, on the other hand, wants to play like a big boy. They still got a lot of nuclear weapons. They have to be treated like a big boy, but in economic terms, and what's going on inside that country, they're more like a middle-income country. You know, they're sort of the eighth of the G8. It's the G7 plus one. And this year, Putin declined even to come to America and hang out at Camp David and so on, and be part of that. So, they want to play and be an international player desperately. They want to. Oil and gas revenue allows them to at least, and the nukes, of course, allow them to be taken seriously. But they've got massive internal problems that require all of their attention and more.
Forget the Russians are trying to build a very close relationship with the Chinese, both on a political and economic front, as a way to buffer themselves against the United States and Western Europe. You have the Shanghai Economic Organization, where the Russians and the Chinese are in a very close contact with each other. And it's going to be interesting to see how that develops in the next few years, because both China and Russia have very nationalistic populace that is very concerned about being dominated by the West.
Well, I want to take that topic, and I want to expand it a little bit more, though, when we look at the total G20 summit. Yeah. We obviously have a situation right now where the Eurozone is in deep, deep financial crisis. Just when we think that they might be coming out and there might be light at the end of the tunnel, not so much. Something else happens. Now, there was some little bit of optimism in the Greek elections, the center-right taking a good chunk of the power there in Athens. Ralph Winnie, is the center-right going to be enough to save Greece in the Euro?
Well, I think it's, they avoided the triggering an immediate disaster. But now you have the tricky part. What's happening is the New Democracy Party is looking to build a coalition with the party that placed third in the elections. And if they can form this new coalition government, Greece is going to face an extremely tricky set of tasks, which it may not be able to pull off. The easiest part is probably going to be getting some interim funding to keep the Greek government from running out of money in July. And you'll probably see Europe bending over backwards to find a reasonable answer to the short-term crisis. However, the hard part is finding a new version of the bailout agreement, which reflects the economic reality that no government in Greece could meet the current deficit targets, the political need for substantial improvements in the terms to mollify a Greek public that strongly dislikes the current agreement, and the need to avoid all the political pitfalls that exist in the rest of Europe, created by the fears that the Greeks are just going to take any additional funding without fulfilling their own promises of reform. You've got the issue in Greece is really twofold. The Greeks are torn between several profound but conflicted feelings. On the one hand, they hate the austerity measures contained in the agreement, they're also very disappointed in the two traditionally dominant parties that got them into this mess. On the other hand, the Greeks strongly support staying in the euro, but the problem comes because the only way to stay in the euro is likely to be accepting the existing agreement with substantially more modest changes than even the New Democracy Party is willing to accept. So it's really a catch-22. I think the Greeks want to stay in the eurozone, but at the same time they can't support the current bailout package that the IMF and the European Union is pushing on them. So it's going to be very interesting. I think it's still likely that they could be kicked out of the eurozone as people become increasingly fed up with them down the line.
Well, Alan Moore, I mean, there's an interesting dynamic going on here. When you look at some of the comments coming out of the international community, it's almost as if Christine Lagarde over at the IMF is sitting there saying, look, Greece, you're screwed if you stay in, you're screwed if you get out, you might as well just stay in and suck it up. Is that really the right approach to take as far as the eurozone's concerned?
Well, you know, we're only talking about Greece so far, and it's hard to know whether whether the political outcome was very interesting, as Ralph said, that you know there seems to be a sentiment that that they want to stay with the euro and try to follow these new instructions or orders, if you will. But saying that and doing that are two different things. And as Ralph points out, they've really only got a few months, even now, and it's hard to see that they're going to be able to meet all the objectives that have been laid upon them, and that will put pressure on everybody else to give even more to Greece, even as they're trying to figure out next steps with Spain and worrying about Italy. We sit here at a distance thinking, why don't the Europeans crack heads somehow and make some hard choices? And then you look at us, and we're not doing half what they're doing, and they're not doing enough. There is this collective notion of pointing fingers, but this is one where there's hard decisions required all over the industrialized world, and no politicians, no political parties, no leaders are really stepping out and having any great success in finding a path forward.
In short, real quickly, and we haven't even gotten to talk to Spain, and obviously we'll probably be talking about this here in the next couple of weeks, but as a whole, how much is the EU and the euro and the eurozone on life support right now? Are we seeing the final straw that may break the camel's back to dissolve the EU as a whole, Bob Hines?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, great expert that I am about the economy of the Western Europe, but I would say this. I would say this. I don't think they're going to fall off a cliff. I mean, it seems to me that if whatever happens, it's a slow motion type of thing. I mean, right now I think Spanish bonds they're trying to sell bonds that it's almost 7% interest, or it is 7%. You can't sustain that kind of an interest payment. Nobody could. And I guess Italy isn't far behind. I gather that the Prime Minister, Mr. Monti, who has been so heralded in the last 6 months about what he's been able to do to get Italy's back together, is now having all kinds of trouble and being backbitten by politicians over there, and Italy seems to be stagnating a bit. It's just one thing after another, and the reality is, until Germany is prepared to do what it has to do with both respect to policy matters and dollars, and upon the policy and euros, I should say, not dollars, but in the policy area, we're talking about they've got to draw together closer. They've got to be able to issue, multi-state euro bonds, and Germany doesn't want to do it. They may well have to at some point, and I think Merkel is just doing all she can to keep her government in place, in also not doing something that the public, which is dead set against too much one world in Europe, it just seems to me that it's going to be a slow, if it goes downhill, it's just going to keep going slowly like it is now. You know, there's something good happens when you see the Greeks vote yes. But you know the majority part, the majority of the voters went to the, Ralph said, to the right. But it's like they got 29.9%, and that real crazy left group got like 27%. I mean, it's not as though they have a government yet. They're the biggest party, and the party they're going to have to line up with is their old traditional rival. Now, that's right. Not going to be easy, no matter what.
Well,
so yeah. my view about the euro in Europe is, I mean, they're not even close to getting their act together, and they won't get their act together until Germany is willing to do some things right now that their public, by a 4-to-1 margin, is dead set against.
What was interesting is that the IMF announced it's doubling its crisis intervention fund from $456 billion, $43 billion of which has been pledged by China. And in a meeting of the BRICS countries, all five, offered to contribute $10 billion to the IMF in exchange for voting reforms, which would give them much greater influence in the organization. So it's going to be interesting to see how that develops in the near future. You also have Antonia Samaras, who led the victorious New Democratic Party, coming out on the record and saying his government will have to make some necessary amendments to its bailout agreement with the EU and the IMF. But German Chancellor Merkel is dismissing that idea right off the bat, saying that the new Greek government has to implement the commitments entered into by the country. So already they're at loggerheads, and this makes it even more likely, even if they do form the coalition government, that Greece is on its way out of the Eurozone.
Well, we're going to obviously keep an eye on this. It's something we're going to be talking about here over the next couple of weeks, but we've got other news that we're going to talk about. Believe it or not, we've only got 15 minutes left in this show, and I know some of you out there listening going, thank God they're going to put this horse down. Hey, reality is we've got a couple of folks with us. This is great stuff. I am going to give Bob Hines credit. Number one, Bob, I want you to go back and make the prediction about the Veep Stakes that you made 2 weeks ago when we were all live at Shelley's.
I believe that I said that the best choice that the Republican nominee, Mr. Romney, could make would be to pick Senator Portman of Ohio because of his long experience in the House, now a senator, and in between those two jobs, he held jobs in the Bush administration, first as trade representative and then as the director of the OMB. He understands every little bit of the budget, and he's going to really be heavily needed both in that area and in relationships with Mr. Romney, who doesn't know the Congress and doesn't know the members. Mr. Portman does. And
now,
highly regarded.
I asked you to bring that up for the sole purpose of that it seems that the Veep Stakes media have been focused on Marco Rubio. Well, there's news today coming out that Marco Rubio has not even been vetted and is not going to be vetted possibly, and that the Romney camp is looking in another direction. Alan Moore, does this surprise you?
Well, I don't believe it, first of all.
Really?
You call it news. I call it a report that's unsubstantiated. Now, whether or not he's been vetted, I think he will be a person who's in the mix. And for political reasons, if not on the merits, they want to keep him in the mix. They don't want to. They'll want a woman or two in the mix, even if I don't believe they'll pick one. So they don't announce when they vet. They don't announce when they don't vet. And there's some reports, and maybe they're true. I would be surprised if they were true, but I think that we won't know who the vice presidential candidate's going to be until we get really close to it. And we won't know who all is considered until we get really close to it. These things are kept very close to the vest. So that's my view on that. I am sorry to say that the guy I was hoping for, I knew it was a long shot, Mitch Daniels, appears to have taken himself out of it by the announcement this week that he's apparently going to become the president of Purdue University when he steps down in January. And I would love to have seen him on the ticket or in an Obama administration. I'm guessing that's not going to happen, and I'm sorry about that.
I would venture to say that him taking the presidency of Purdue probably foregoes that. I would agree. Just so you know where we're getting this from, Alan Moore pointed out, there is a report out of Politico and ABC News. It is being reported by ABC's John Carl that knowledgeable Republican sources say that Marco Rubio is not being vetted by Romney's vice presidential search team. The statement continues, he has not been asked to complete any questionnaires or has been asked to turn over any documents, specifically financial documents, that are usually required for the candidates. John Carl also goes on and says, although it is possible that Rubio may be asked to go through the vetting process, it has been nearly 2 months since they named Beth Myers to run the search. And the fact that Rubio has not been asked to turn over documents is a strong indication that he is not on the short list. That is out of Politico and out of ABC News. Now, again, this could be a head fake, Bob Hines. We've seen head fakes before. but it seems consistent, and I can't believe I'm going to give you credit for this, it almost seems consistent that they're going the route that you might have mentioned when you started talking about the possible nominee being Senator Portman.
Well, of course, you know that I'm an intimate friend of Mr. Romney. I'm just looking at it from the standpoint of what he lacks. And he lacks someone that has the credentials that Portman has.
And he needs
those credentials. He needs, if he doesn't have them himself, he's got to find somebody who does have them.
Congressman Al, I mean, you've been around and you've seen, you know, the vetting procedures on Veeps. In reality, this is kind of a timing issue. We're not that far away from Tampa. They still have to go through. I guess it's a matter of are they going to be overly cautious, or do you think that they've already picked one? And being overly cautious, I bring up the situation with Sarah Palin back 4 years ago.
Yeah, they certainly weren't overly cautious there. I think there are a number of candidates that do not live in Alaska that are perfectly reasonable and probably do not require a lot of in-depth vetting. And so I think that they can play the game of keeping everybody guessing. They will, of course, do some vetting. But I think when the time comes, it may very well be a surprise. Romney may kind of hold that out there and toy with people, mostly the public, get a guessing game focused on it, and then come up with a strong candidate. He may, on the other hand, come out with somebody earlier on, and whether he does either one will probably depend on how the overall general election campaign is going.
Alan Moore, do you think that, in your opinion, because of course everybody listens to us because of our deep ties into the Romney and Obama camps, but in your opinion of being around Washington as long as you have, this does kind of send a signal a little bit that maybe they're looking at another direction, this, or again, could this be a head fake?
You know, I don't think that Rubio is going to be on the ticket. I said that months ago. I do think Rubio will be in the mix. So these reports I consider as reports and not hard news. When Rubio says it or when Romney says it, then I'll believe it. I like Portman as a candidate. There are several people that I like, but you know, I'm just not convinced that Rubio's now out of the mix.
Alan, you're talking about an election camp, a campaign camp that has literally had one of the tightest seals on it when it comes to media leaks. This doesn't get out, at least out of the Romney media camp, unless there's some validity to it, or are we reading too much?
No, wait. It doesn't say it came out of the Romney camp. Jonathan Carl, ABC, you know, talks to some Republicans who know Rubio and say, yeah, he hasn't been asked for anything. Maybe he has, maybe he hasn't. I don't know. Just because one guy reports it and
two people.
No. Jonathan Carl reported it and Politico repeated it.
Oh, okay.
It came from Jonathan Carl, right? From ABC.
True.
And Politico reported that. So it's not news. I suppose it's news that John Carl said it, but John Carl reported that that's what he's heard. You know, we don't need to then move forward on the basis of that thin thread of fact.
welcome back, Alan.
I've been saving up.
You have been. We missed you. Hey, also, we're coming up to that point in the show where we talk about my favorite, the last 5 minutes of the show. It's my favorite part of the show. It's Tell Me a Story, where we talk about rumors, apparently, like I'm spreading, innuendo or buzz that might be out there. It's when we get to try and scoop the other media sources because we know that they're all listening. And by the way, if they're listening today, wow, have they gotten an earful. I want to start this week with Carl Tuvin. Carl Tuvin, tell me a story. Carl? No, Carl.
That was quick.
That was quick. Ralph Winnie, tell me a story. And we lost Ralph Winnie. Wow, they're what? Even my own team is dropping on us. My God. Alan Moore, tell me a story.
All right. So Governor Walker prevailed in his recall election for numerous reasons, but not least of all was because the burden that public employees have placed on state and local governments is not is simply not sustainable. I don't blame the employees for that. It is sort of this insidious connection between public employee unions and elected officials, and nobody to really counterbalance, if you will, because public officials can worry, just send the problem down the road. I believe, though, that the recall, that his election in the first place, what he was able to do, and the recall is the harbinger of things to come around the country. We saw a little bit in San Diego when they cut pensioner benefits. A study came out this week that right now state and local governments are $1.3 trillion down in what they owe to both in pension benefits and in health benefits. And I think we've only seen the tip of the iceberg in what state and local governments are going to have to do to be able to survive going forward. And it's going to be a very, very painful, controversial, angry, and difficult adjustment.
Interesting. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
Well, I'm not going to tell you a story. What I'm going to do is just repeat what I said earlier, who the vice presidential nominee is going to be. The more I think about it, the more I look at what Mr. Romney needs, the more I believe that he is the very best choice, and I think that Mr. Romney will find him very compatible.
Wow, good call. Al Swift, Congressman Al, tell me a story.
I have been confused from the very beginning that a man who is as articulate and can give as great a speech as Barack Obama can has been unable to capsulize his various achievements in concrete, simple terms that can sell and be repeated by Democrats along the line. I think he has not been given credit. He's not taken credit. He's not given the Democrats the opportunity and the toehold to be able to take credit for what was done with the banks, for what was done with saving American automobile industry, for a variety of things like that. And as I watch his campaign, I don't see him being able to do the same thing with the little issues that are coming up. Here is my story. If he doesn't soon figure out how to be as effective on selling the issues that he's got as he does painting the broad picture, he's going to lose.
Wow. Wow. That is coming from you, Al. That's a pretty striking tale. Shameless plug for me. Shameless plug for me is going to be last week at a candidate forum. Republican candidate for Oklahoma 2nd District, Dan Boren's old seat, Dakota Wood, retired Marine, came out in a candidate forum and said that there is going to be a runoff next Tuesday. The election results will have a runoff between him and current state representative George Fought in the highly contested six-way race for the Republican nomination. Mark my words, he is calling his shot, so we'll see how that goes. Next week, obviously, I'm going to be out of pocket, so that means it's going to be a best of because it's election day here in Oklahoma for primary season. But we will be live back on July 3rd. We will be live in Shelley's back room, all of us, and we'll be able to have a real show again. On behalf of Alan Moore, Congressman Al Swift, Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, and Carl Tubin, this is your moderator, Russell. You know what? Have a great week, folks. I can't even get out my closing. This has been Backroom Politics. I know, exactly.
Good luck Tuesday.
Hey, thanks a lot. This has been Backroom Politics.
Yeah, good luck.
Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. Bob?
The place to be, and we
That's
will
right.
be there in 2 weeks.
We'll all be there in 2 weeks. Folks, have a great time, America. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.